Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Here, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Here newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Brexit Means, The Guardian's weekly guide to all that's happening and even all that isn't in the exciting world of Brexit. This time, in the latest in our occasional series on how different EU27 countries think of Brexit, we're going to be looking at France. What do Britain's closest European neighbours make of our decision to leave the bloc? What's their strategy for dealing with it? And is it the case that they even, perish the thought, hope to benefit from it? Now, what the French think matters, obviously, not just because, along with Germany, France's voice is obviously one of the more important in Europe, especially under its energetic and unashamedly pro-European new president, Emmanuel Macron. So it may have a disproportionate influence over the end result of Brexit. But it matters also because France is, for most Brits, after all, where foreign begins. The two countries have a long and, shall we say, tangled history. Anyway, with me to discuss France and Brexit are, on the line, Sonia de la Salle Stolper, who is the UK and Ireland correspondent for the French newspaper Libération. And here in the studio, Eric Albert, who writes for Le Monde, mainly on UK economic affairs and the city, and Renaud Thiers, an EU and French politics and policy analyst with the business advisory firm Flint Global, who, like everyone else, is probably spending rather more time on Brexit at present than is altogether good for him. So, welcome to all of you. Can we begin a little bit at the beginning? Sonia, you've been in the UK for probably longer than you'd like to be reminded of, I imagine. How would you characterise the way that France saw the UK as a partner when Britain was still in the EU? I mean, we are still for another year or so in the EU. But obviously, the two countries haven't always seen eye to eye. The question is, will France miss Britain in Europe?
Well, I think, yes, as you say, I've been here for much too long now to admit. I've seen quite a lot of what happened politically in the UK. In terms of the relationship, I would say Britain has always been seen as a little bit the annoying member of the, you know, European Union, the one always asking for some special treatment, not that it has changed actually today. But on the other hand, it has as well always been seen as a very pragmatic, reasonable country, which I think is a perception which has drastically changed over the last 18 months.
Okay. Yes. Renaud, is Paris glad to see the back of London then? I mean, the British have always seen Europe as a kind of a sort of a French Gallic political project, really, haven't they? Will Britain's departure increase France's influence in the 27, do you think?
Well, I think it was clearly the initial reaction. You know, there was a bit of, as we say in German, Schadenfreude.
Yes.
To see Brexit happening, and it was a widespread feeling among the French public. But having said that, once you've said, well, this is a great opportunity to relaunch the EU, we're going to do great things with Germany, finally, we won't have the Brits holding us back. Well, if you look at it a bit more closely, in 1.5 years' distance, I think today the view is more balanced, actually. And I mean, I have the feeling, I don't know about Eric and Sonia, but I have the feeling France is entering a sort of Brexit phase. I mean, its own phase two of Brexit, starting to look at how Brexit is going to impact different economic sectors, how it's going to affect the strategic relationship with Britain. Because ultimately, and here France and the UK, I think, are very pragmatic. They want very strong security relationship to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling is that today, senior officials in Paris would rather avoid anything that would disrupt the strategic relationship. So they won't allow Brexit to disrupt too much, I would say.
Okay, well, I mean, that's going to create some tensions, though, isn't it, within the EU? Because France so far has been very careful, or has been one of the main proponents, one of the main voices of that EU mantra of the four freedoms must be preserved, you know, no cherry picking and all that kind of thing.
I mean, it is true. And I think it's still true. I mean, if you listen, what Macron says and what French ministers say. But I would say there's a bit of a contrast between the French and the German attitudes here, because the German keep quiet and didn't make a lot of noise at first.
Mm-hmm.
But today, in fact, they are taking a very, you know, legalistic hard line. You know,
yeah.
And they are saying, well, you know, if you want single market access, it will have a, you know, very high cost. And I think the French might be wonder if there are any ways around this. You know.
Well, that's interesting.
It's my impression,
okay.
At least talking to people in Paris.
Okay. Well, we'll explore that a little bit further, and we'll talk a bit more detail about the bilateral relationships later. But Eric, I just wanted to come to you. Do you think there was a surprise, really, in France at the way, at the actual fact of the vote? You know, I know the Brits have always been, as Sonia was saying, the sort of EU angry brigade. But did France actually expect them to leave?
I don't think so, but I don't think many people in Britain were expecting Britain to actually vote out, including Brexiters who voted. You know, it was such a close margin. But, you know, Sonia said it well. Britain was seen as the annoying member of the family, but it was a member of the family. And so it's never nice to see a member of the family leaving. I don't think there's anyone rejoicing. But, you know, judging from the comments of my readers, people do read a lot about Brexit. They are very interested.
Mm.
And before the referendum, you had quite a strand of people saying, well, you know what? We've had enough of the EU as well. I can understand some Brexiters. Since that has disappeared. And now you got only two strands of replies, really, which is one is good riddance.
Mm-hmm.
You do have still some of that. And most of it is, why such an act of self-harm? Why? You know, explain me. What are you doing, you Brits? And this is really what people mostly write. And from far away, there might be now a slight change in France, but from far away, it looks like a very strange thing that is happening here.
An act of self-harm.
When I said that Britain has always been a little bit the annoying member of the family, the uncle at the table who is always moaning about something and wanting something more, a bit more wine or a bit different wine or whatever, it's true in one way. But the other way is as well that the fact that Britain has always been at the heart of the European Union and at the heart of quite a lot of fundamental bits which have made what it is today. I mean, including, or first and foremost, maybe the single market.
The single market,
it was, it was a British initiative initially, or the enlargement of the EU. So I don't think, and I agree with Eric on that I don't think anyone is happy about Britain leaving, and even less since it's been clear that it is super, super complicated to leave the EU. And it doesn't look, for now, I mean, we haven't seen anywhere, apart from the rather optimistic, or I would say, wishful thinking of quite a lot of member of government saying that there is anything positive about Brexit. We haven't seen anything, and I think the public sees that as well in around Europe. And I think as well from what Renaud was saying about the perspective from the vision in Germany and the vision in France. I think in France we have to separate the vision of the public opinion, which are basically based on what they read in the papers or see on TV, and what they see is basically that it is very complicated, and the vision from the government, who is much more aware of the necessity of keeping a close relationship with Britain. But, and I think that they are all agree on that, being in France or in Germany, it can't be at the cost of the European Union structure. And the European Union structure is a very legal body, and you have to respect the legality of it and the rules of it. So I can't see France being softer than Germany on the four freedoms, for example.
Okay, now both of you in the studio here wanted to come in on that. Eric, you first.
No, just one quick thing. Yeah. Historical reminder, we all know that, but you know, Britain has always been at the heart of the European Union. Not quite. It was not there at the beginning. Of course, de Gaulle said no twice and joined only much later. So it has always been a bit of a special
A semi-outsider. Yes, that was best captured for me by a fantastic tweet from Xavier Bettel, the Prime Minister of Luxembourg, a few months ago, who tweeted sort of words to the effect, basically, of bloody Brits. You know, when they were in, all they wanted was opt-outs, and now they want to be out, and all they want is opt-ins. Renaud, you wanted to come in. This question of the four freedoms, because, I mean, it is true, isn't it, that in even in the days after the referendum, François Hollande, who was your then president, obviously was very quick to come out and with this sort of no cherry picking line. Since last summer's election, Emmanuel Macron, who succeeded him, obviously has been, you know, if anything, even more forthright. Britain cannot expect to retain the benefits of membership without the obligations, and so on. I mean, those have to be real red lines for France, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clearly the starting point, you know, of the EU27 position and of the French position that, yes, the single market has rules. And where the UK, I mean, if the UK wants to retain the advantages of the single market, it has to abide by the rules. And I think this is very clear. This is a very simple message to communicate to the public. And clearly, France will keep, you know, I mean, we'll stick to this line, because it's also the line on which there is a consensus with the other, you know, 27 members. Having said that, once you say that, of course, the second leg is also to look at your own interests, you know, and your own situation. Geographical situation with the UK, your own economic interests, your own strategic relationship. And so I think French officials at the moment are probably trying to square the circle between, you know, keeping this very, you know, sort of high-level, very clear line about rules, rules associated with the single market, but at the same time trying to find pragmatic ways to defend French interests, or to protect French interests. And clearly here, France's interests are not aligned with those of Germany and of other countries. So there might be, you know, sort of small space for France to play with, or to, you know, to operate in, within, to protect French interests.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's look at a little bit more closely at what those interests might be, starting, Eric, with you, with trade, really. Can you just, I'm not looking specifically at the city at the moment. We'll come on to that in a second. But what is the nature of Franco-British trade? Is France expecting, or indeed even preparing, to take a kind of potential hit in the event of a hard Brexit? And sure, I mean, there are some, I mean, regions of France, the northern France, for example, and the whole area around Calais, the Channel ports. I mean, if in the event of a real kind of catastrophic Brexit, I mean, they would genuinely suffer, wouldn't they?
The official forecast from the French Treasury, under any scenario, is Brexit will hit the French economy. Now, more or less, and of course, much less than what Britain would be
Hit. Sure.
So there's still this imbalance, and that's why the Brexiter argument that, you know, you need us more than we need you doesn't quite work. But there is a bit of truth.
An element of truth.
The French wines need to be exported somewhere, and yes, goods are mostly exported from France to Britain, not the other way around. There is a net benefit for France on that. There's one exception, and very quickly, on the city. The financial sector, which is a very regulated sector, is from Britain to Europe. It's exported pretty much one way. And this is, so the obvious consequence for France, the logical consequence for that is we need a free trade deal on goods, industrial goods, possibly farming, although it's complicated, but, you know, industrial goods for sure. But finance, no way. No way France is going to let the passporting back to Britain after Brexit.
Okay, well, that's interesting. We'll talk about the city in a second. Macron's visit last month, we heard quite a lot, didn't we, from the sort of more excitable sections of the British press about a possible bespoke deal for Britain. But on the other hand, as Eric was saying, he also made it very clear that there could be no kind of tailored arrangement for the city unless the UK was prepared to pay into the budget and accept the EU rules and everything. And, you know, what is the actual... I mean, my sense is that the really Macron wasn't straying very far at all from the official EU line. What's your take?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm always amazed by the reading of the British press. I mean, I should say of the British Eurosceptic press towards anything said by any European leader or member of the Commission or member of the European Parliament. What Emmanuel Macron did when he came here for that bilateral summit was doing exactly what he has been saying over and over since he's been elected president, that he wants a very close relationship with Britain, that we have historic and very strong relationships in terms of security, of defense, of I mean, all those are really very precious. I mean, we are the only two countries in the European Union with nuclear power. So it is very true, and he said that and repeated that. But he said as well that there was no way that he would give... I mean, the bespoke deal, he never said that. The bespoke deal was what Theresa May was saying while they were having their common press conference. And he answered back saying... You can have an agreement if you respect the four freedoms. So about the financial services, for example, no way you can't have a deal if you don't respect the four freedoms, specifically the freedom of movement, to which Theresa May responded, I still want to have an agreement with the services in. And I'm afraid there is a really clear misunderstanding there, a non-wish of understanding what has been said. And it's not that Macron said anything new at all.
So sort of willful misinterpretation. Renaud, you wanted to...
Well, my own understanding of this episode is that he actually did say something about, yes, that there will be a deal or indeed a bespoke... I mean, I'm not sure he used the word bespoke, but a deal... which will be tailored to, you know, the reality of the UK being, you know, very large, important.
But no more, I guess, than in a sense that every deal will be unique because every deal is unique.
Exactly. Yeah. By definition, the deal will be bespoke. But he also kind of implied there would be something between, you know, it's not the alternative is not just, as Michel Barnier repeats, between either you go Norway or you go Canada. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, if there is a free trade agreement like Canada, well, you can expect the services chapter to be a bit more, you know, robust or a bit more, you know, and typically, I mean,
expanded services.
Yeah, I mean, you can expect regulatory dialogue in financial services typically, or perhaps some forms of joint supervision. I don't know, but so I think that's what he meant, indeed.
Okay.
But saying this is indeed very far from saying, well, yeah, you can have you can be part of the single market for financial services, or
and sort of quite revealing, I suppose, of the projections that the pro-Brexit media and indeed pro-Brexit politicians here are.
But I mean, what he did say at the Andrew Marshall was, you know, because he was asked of Canada and Norway and those two extreme models. And he said, well, there is something in between. And it's just a matter of fact. We know there's something in between. There's at least Switzerland. I know the EU said we don't want to replicate the Switzerland deal. And actually, no one in Switzerland is defending their own deal anymore. So that makes it a bit complicated, but it exists. So there are stuff in between. And at the end, the most likely scenario is there will be some kind of agreement somewhere in between. But probably, I mean, the quid pro quo, which is, you know, freedom of movement means, I mean, single market means freedom of movement. This quid pro quo has not gone. It's still there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, on top of Switzerland, there's also Ukraine, which is, I know, a very attractive model for the UK.
Okay. Let's just return briefly to this bilateral. We've touched on it already, but it is important, this bilateral relationship. You know, above and beyond that magnificent coup of the Bayer tapestry and everything, you know, which was a really very grand and imaginative diplomatic gesture, which quite possibly will never happen. But leaving that aside, you know, the France got quite a bit out of that summit, didn't it? Really, extra cash, manpower for the border at Calais, helicopter support in Africa, and this kind of thing. Renaud, you said France was having to consider very carefully and weigh up its national interest. Didn't that summit reveal, in a way? Certainly, I, as an observer of these kind of bilateral summits for many years now, I don't think I can remember one where the balance of power was quite so out of kilter, really. I mean, it's quite clear, wasn't it, that Britain is the needier of the two partners at the moment?
Yeah, no, it's true. It conveyed this impression that, May was basically offering a number of things and Macron was just taking. I mean, he sees... I think the Franco-British relationship has a sort of separate avenue or channel, if you want. And he knows that, yes, because May tries to, you know, sort of soften France's stance on Brexit, she has to give, you know, she has to give to him as part of the bilateral relationship.
He's sort of playing that for all it's worth.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, it's he's being very pragmatic about it. There's a favorable context. Typically, if the Brits wants the French to cooperate on customs and to facilitate customs procedures after Brexit, well, the Brits might need to show some goodwill on controlling people. I mean, on paying more, you know, to control people and to get some migrants from Calais. So that was the kind of trade-off which was at play. Although they didn't talk about Brexit because officially it's a non-issue. You know, it's an issue which is dealt with at European level.
And officially it's not a bilateral issue.
Exactly.
But that was the backdrop of everything. Yeah. You know, the balance of power would not have been so unequal without Brexit, of course. And that's what changed everything.
Of course.
And I love that. You know, how about a reminder that we invited you 1,000 years ago and in exchange you give us more manpower? That sounds like a good deal to me.
But do you think that's going to, Eric, I mean, turning to you, does that the strength of that special relationship, even if at the moment it does look sort of particularly one way, but there's clearly a strong relationship there which both sides value. Is that going to be able to provide any kind of leverage for Britain during the actual Brexit negotiations? Or is France going to succeed, as Uno was saying, in basically keeping the two things completely separate?
I think it's impossible to keep it completely separate, but that's going to be very difficult for Theresa May to actually use that. Because she tried, remember, a year ago to say, we might, change a little bit our defense agreement with the rest of Europe if we don't have a good deal. She had to row back from that right
very
away
fast.
Because, actually, it is in Britain's interest to keep that relationship both sides. So it's very hard to see what leverage Theresa May has, really. It's facing much bigger partner, 27 countries. And so how do you possibly negotiate with that? It's very, very difficult. So she will try, and she will try to put a wedge between Germany and France and Poland. That's going to be really tough. The first phase didn't show the EU disintegrating at all, and the second phase, I can't see it happening either.
Yeah. Okay, let's look at a little bit at areas where France may be seeking to sort of actively profit from Brexit. Eric, just briefly, I mean, Paris has made a very big and quite highly publicised play for some of this City of London business after Brexit, hasn't it? I mean, how serious is France about finding that upside, and will Paris be able to strengthen its position as a kind of continental financial hub?
The French financial sector sees it as, you know, one chance in 30 years. You know, for 30 years or so, you know, the French Paris has gone down as a financial sector. And then suddenly two things happen, Brexit and Macron. And, you know, for them, I mean, they are rejuvenated, they speak in a completely different way, they can imagine Paris as a dynamic place. How much of that will actually translate in facts remains to be seen, but they've played to the maximum of their hands, really to the maximum.
Yeah, Sonia, I mean, you've been at some of these presentations when people from the sort of Paris financial world have come over to London. How do you think they've been received here?
Well, I think they've been received a bit of a bemusement, because I think they've always been, and there is still quite a little tiny bit of, I mean, there is that huge self-confidence here that London is the center of the financial world, I mean, not just for Europe, but for the rest of the world, and that it's not going to change. So I think here it was received, I mean, I looked at my, you know, the British journalists who were present as well, and they were quite skeptical, for sure. On the other hand, I think more than just a question of bringing back a lot of, you know, financial bits and bobs to Paris, it is quite a question of symbolism as well. It's as Eric was saying, I mean, fortunes of France have completely changed in the last year and a half, because, I mean, I remembered you just after Brexit having to discuss and argue with lots of commentators here that Marine Le Pen wasn't a deal done as a president in France. And because there was that feeling here, maybe it was a bit of wishful thinking as well, that saying after, you know, after Brexit, after Trump, yeah, surely in France you're going to have that populist movement as well winning, and you'll have Marine Le Pen. We haven't. We have Emmanuel Macron, and the economy of the European Union is getting better. So I think in terms of symbols, if you look at the agency, European Banking Agency, who is going to go to Paris, in terms of jobs, it's not a huge amount. I can't remember. I think it's 200 people. So it's not a huge amount of people economically. But in terms of symbolism, I think it's important, because it means France is there. It's there in the game and ready to play, something
France
like that.
France is back, as certain Monsieur Macron likes to say. Okay, Renaud, you know, there's quite a bit of confusion clearly here, apart from anywhere else, but also on the continent, about what Britain actually wants from Brexit, isn't it? Or maybe that's not really fair. I mean, it is, you know, it's pretty clear what Britain wants, but what's equally clear is that that's just not possible. You know, Britain kind of seems to be persisting in wanting something that simply isn't on the table. I mean, does France share that view, do you think? Does Paris basically not get where Britain's coming from, why it's persisting in this line?
No, I mean, I think, as you say, they get what Britain would want to get or to obtain, but they know that it's not possible, and they know that British officials know it's not possible, and they're just waiting for a signal, you know, they're just waiting to see whether, you know, the sort of balance is going to tip or to, So, I mean, French officials are at this stage a little bit embarrassed, frankly, because they don't know. You know, they have no clue. They really feel for Theresa May, because they understand she's torn. You know, she's.
I mean, and I think, to be fair, you know, quite apart from whatever you think about Theresa May's qualities or lack of them, I think any leader would struggle, having been dealt the hand that she's been dealt.
Indeed. I mean, it really looks like, you know, Britain is coming back to the situation where it was in the late 50s and early 60s, where it didn't quite know what it wanted, you know, whether to be, you know, fully engaged with Europe, with European partners, or whether, you know, to look elsewhere. France, especially under Macron, has sort of renewed its pro-European, pro-EU commitment in a quite spectacular way. And Britain looks, a little bit
unsure of itself. Eric, it feels like the balance is shifting.
Very much so. And, you know, one thing on the city, what's really interesting is the people who have been convinced by Macron really are the French of the city. So it's French people who worked here and who have for a very long time practice quite heavily French bashing, thinking, gosh, we can't get anything right. Look at the Thatcherite way, it's much better. And are finally feeling, that the balance is changing.
Proud to be French again.
Exactly. And some of them, but you know, we're talking about a few thousand jobs maximum are going back. So there is this sense, but a word of caution, you know, Macron won with really 26% of the votes, a quarter of the electorate. Marine Le Pen did not as well, but you know, it wasn't that far. It was 20%, 21, whatever it was. So, and if there was a Frexit vote in France, I'm not quite sure how it would turn out. So, you know, all of that right now is indeed the balance is shifting. Indeed, you know, the Eurozone crisis is a bit behind us. Mm-hmm. The refugee crisis is a bit behind us. The spectacle of Britain is deplorable right now, but it might change again. So, you know, the balance is shifting, but has not shifted yet.
I would add to this that Macron has invested a lot of political capital into EU integration, Eurozone reform. So he's trying to push hard to get a sort of grand deal with Germany, but it might not happen. Clearly, the sort of grand coalition scenario is good for him. I mean, it's better for him than other options in Germany. But still, German policymakers, politicians are very skeptical about a sort of great leap forward. What will happen? You know, if Macron doesn't get very much, he will be under heavy criticism from Laurent Wauquiez, the new Republican leader. Marine Le Pen and Mélenchon will say, well, look, you can't do anything with this EU, so there's no point,
The picture could yet shift. Okay, we're running a little bit out of time. Sonia, I just wanted one quick question, and we sort of touched on it just there, but, France has a couple of quite strongly Eurosceptic parties, doesn't it? How has the sort of spectacle of Brexit and this evidence, really, that's becoming clearer every day that trying to leave the EU is a very, very difficult job. How is that being perceived in France?
Well, I think it's probably one of the only positive side of Brexit, actually. It has raised, and not just in France, but everywhere, the feeling that actually European Union is not that bad at all. The European feeling has grown. I think that there are quite a lot of people around Europe and actually even in Britain who are suddenly realizing or discovering what being European means. Mm. And talking about Mélenchon or about Jean-Marie Le Pen, Marine Le Pen, sorry, I'm kind of mixing up father and daughter. It's quite interesting to see that the Front National began its presidential campaign with an agenda which was arguing for a Frexit, coming out of the European Union plus coming out of the Euro. And as the campaign was going on, and parallelly the discussion on Brexit here were clearly not being resolved very quickly, you could basically they just let down those, they forgot those arguments, and they said, well, actually, maybe we're not talking about a referendum and Frexit, and maybe let's not talk about coming out of the Euro. So it is not right now. There is no discussion and no appetite for a referendum on Frexit in France at all. It doesn't mean that if there was a referendum tomorrow, lots of unsatisfied people would maybe vote for it. But no one is actually going right now to argue for that.
Okay, final question. I'm going to put you each on the spot, if you don't mind. Sonia, let's start with you. We are in February 2018. In 13 months' time, Britain will leave the European Union. What form will Brexit take? Where do you think it's going to go?
I don't know. And I have been trying to figure out what could happen for the last 18 months. And every time I've been trying to make any prediction, I've been proved wrong, because everything is so fragile and so unsettled and that I wouldn't dare. I mean, right now, I think the main big problem and the one who might completely destroy Brexit is actually the island question.
Yeah.
I can't see in any way how they can resolve that without staying in the customs union at least. So either the government decide that after all that's the only way to save their so-called Brexit, or either they carry on without that, and then I don't see where they're going.
Okay, Renaud?
Well, I mean, I think the baseline scenario is that in 13 months' time, you know, in early spring to 2019, Britain and the EU will move towards, a sort of first transition period, or perhaps an open-ended transition period, on the basis of a very generally worded agreement, which will have solved absolutely nothing, including the Irish question.
Okay.
And so
everything's just going to be kicked down the road.
Yeah. I think so, yeah. And clearly, until then, who knows what may happen on the political front here in the UK. So
that's the big question, certainly. Yeah. Eric, final word?
My bet is that there will be a deal, not very detailed, that, you know, the cliff edge is extremely unlikely. I don't really believe in a massive political crisis. It can happen anytime, but I don't really believe in it. And I think we are going towards some kind of free trade agreements on industrial goods and not on services, probably not on farm either. But that's going to take, I mean, the one thing that's for sure, it's going to take forever. We'll talk about that again in 2019 and 2020 and so on and so forth.
Okay. See you again in 2022. All right. Well, that is it then for this week. My thanks to Sonia, to Eric, to Renaud for joining me today. If you have any questions or suggestions about topics we should be looking at, or if you just want to get in touch, do please email us at brexitpodcast. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. Please subscribe, review on all your favorite podcatchers, join the discussion on Twitter. You just need to search for Guardian Podcasts. Till next week then, I'm John Henley. The producer was Max Sanderson. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.